Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Ron Suskind has an extraordinary story to tell about his son, Owen, who was diagnosed with autism just shy of his third birthday. For the first 3 years of his life, Owen was a typical, happy toddler who suddenly fell silent. A diagnosis of regressive autism follows, which affects about a third of children with autism spectrum disorders. Little Owen stopped talking. He retreated into himself. But he retained a passion for Disney movies, their stories, characters, and their language, which eventually provided the key that allowed him to re-engage with his family and the world. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind wrote about Owen's journey in his book Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. It's now the subject of a new documentary film, which has its Boston area premiere tonight at the Kendall Square Cinema in Cambridge. We spoke with Ron Suskind after his book came out 2 years ago. It's a powerful story, which we wanted to revisit today. I began by asking Ron what Owen was like before he was diagnosed with regressive autism.
Before his diagnosis, he's chatting away at two and a half, usual few hundred word vocabulary of a 2.5-year-old. We moved to Washington. I was working at the Wall Street Journal, and that's when all of a sudden he starts to lose function, ability. And after 3 months in Washington, he's down to one word. Juice was his only word. And he was drinking at that point from a sippy cup. He graduated to the big boy cup about 1.5 years before, but he was back to the baby cup. And at that point, Cornelia and I said, we need to see a specialist. And that's when we heard autism for the first time.
And so what did hearing that word do to you? I mean, how did you respond?
Well, it's you can almost do a before and after. I can see those two people, Cornelia and me, sitting on the chair when we hear it for the first time. And then we seem to escape from our bodies and look down on those two people frozen in place. And the doctors explained to us, look, some kids never get their speech back. You have to be aware of that. This is a life journey you're now embarking on. You've got to think about supporting them for the next 50 years and for 30 years after you're dead. This is an adult moment.
Yeah. As you say, many people with this diagnosis never get their speech back. But here's Owen, who retains this passion for Disney films, which he watched with his older brother, Walt. So tell us what happened one day in November of 1994 when you and your wife are watching The Little Mermaid with him, and he begins to say something you're not sure what.
Yeah, well, he's been murmuring a phrase, juicervos, for a few months. Now, he's not speaking at this point, and so we can't make sense of it. And then we're watching The Little Mermaid. And there's a moment, I think many people have seen this movie, where Ariel, the protagonist, wants to become human. Ursula, the sea witch, says there will be a price. It won't cost you much. A trifle, really, just your voice. Owen's rewinding that part. Second, third rewind. Cornelia all of a sudden says it's not juice. It's just your voice. He's saying just your voice. I grab Owen. I say just your voice. He's saying juicervos. We thought this was the moment of breakthrough. It's the first time he really looks at me in a year because, you know, the gaze aversion is part of autism. And we jump up and down in the bed. Walter's saying, Owen's talking again. We go to our doctors, though, a week or two later, and they say, let's sit down. Let's discuss this. This is called echolalia. Many folks who lose the ability to speak or auditory processing or process what they hear, they mimic sounds, just like a parrot.
So it's echo. So they're echoing what they hear.
Just like what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And that goes on for years, where we hear phrases bubbling up. You know, booty lies within was the next year. That's beauty lies within. But still, we don't know if he's understanding or what he's understanding. Now, meanwhile, Cornelia's working round the clock. You know, every day, every night, Owen is not sleeping, so she's up every night with him. Every therapist we can find. A little bit of speech is coming back, 2-3-word sentences. And then when he's about 6.5, his brother gets a little emotional on his birthday. He's 9 years old, his older brother, Walt, and Owen walks in to the kitchen on the day of Walt's birthday and says Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan. Now, this is his first real sentence at six and a half.
Walter doesn't want to grow up. So he's really a scribe. I mean, he's really interpreting something here. He can't just be sort of mimicking words.
Yeah, well, that was the moment we said, oh, my God, there's a world in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, well, people who know these movies, it's like Aladdin in the Cave of Wonders. It's like that giant head emerges from the sand and then disappears back. So the question was, how do you get back in? And really, our challenge was to get back in that stretched across years. At that point, we start to play out scenes from movies. We realized that he had memorized them, whether he understood them or not, he had the sounds down, like putting down tracks of music.
Right.
And if you threw him a line, he'd throw you back the next line, and you threw him the next, and he'd throw back the next.
We have a clip to play, Ron. This is from a documentary that Roger Ross Williams just began filming about your family. And here you are talking to Owen about that really pivotal moment in your relationship with him when he was six and a half. You pick up a puppet of the character Iago, which is the parrot from Aladdin.
Yeah, the sidekick to the villain Jafar.
Sidekick, right, who's voiced by Gilbert Gottfried. But here we're going to hear you talking about that moment with your son Owen. It's a brief clip, but let's listen.
Owen does Gilbert Gottfried better than I do, but I had to do Gilbert. So I say, so Owen, wait a minute. How does it feel to be you?
I ain't lonely and I don't have any friends.
Yeah. You know, and that was the first time we had a conversation, really, you and me, since you're about two.
Yeah.
Incredibly powerful moment there. So take us back to that day. And you know, he actually said that, I'm lonely and I don't have any friends.
Yeah.
He's channeling Disney there, but boy, he seems to be communicating something real about himself.
Well, the key was after that night, after Owen says about Mowgli or Peter Pan, I went up to his room and I put on the puppet and I talked to him as Iago, the puppet. And that is the moment where he turns to Iago like bumping into an old friend and he speaks back in a voice that I had never really heard. At that point, our house went into a kind of insanity,
right.
a lovely insanity in its way, where we said, look, we just have to play out all the parts of these movies we can find. So we start what we call the basement sessions, where Cornelia and I and Walt, his older brother, and of course Owen, start playing out scenes from movies. And Owen had memorized about 20 of the Disney movies. Again, this is the thing a lot of these kids do. It's actually called scripting by some of the therapists. They memorize the words, the scripts, and we played them out. And the key was, he not only give you back the line from Mowgli, let's say, or from Arthur, or from Simba, he would emote through the words, and that made us feel he understood what he was saying. And over years, he began to understand it. That was clear.
So what happened? How did this Disney material help him do that? What's the theory there?
Well, the theory is a couple of things. First off, plain and simple, Walt Disney takes these iconic tales that go back thousands of years, just like the Brothers Grimm did. These are part of folklore, the stories we told ourselves to make our way in the world.
Yeah.
And so they're iconic stories full of emotion. Now, Disney, when he begins this era of animation in the 30s, he says to the animators, I want these things to be so vivid to the eye, the expressions, the situations, that you can understand them without the sound on.
Mm.
Now, what could be better? Now, you get to the 80s, another clear twist, just an oddity, is that at that point, the VCR arrives at domestic home use. People pretty much all had VCRs by the mid-80s. The key is autistic spectrum kids could then rewind the tapes. Before that, you had to go to the movie theater.
Yeah.
You know, that was over. It was the era in which images could be part of a free feed. And this creates a change because they could rewind them over and over again and so-called hyper-systemize them. That's actually the neuroscientist term, to go deeper and deeper, to understand what was happening, to dig into new details, to meditate over the interaction of characters. And that's the way many of them, not just Owen, many of them had found a way to make sense of complex reality. It's almost like one of the neuroscientists, because many neuroscientists are now studying this called affinity therapy. That's the idea. Cornelia and I had to give it a name. That's what we called it. And they're finding that they're using their affinity almost like the Enigma machine in World War II, the code breaker, to break the code of the wider world. They turn the affinity into a toolkit, navigational equipment, and a language that ultimately ends up being a thing of high utility.
I want to just ask you this. I mean, this is an astonishing story, and we're going to talk a little bit about how Owen is doing today, and he's doing much, 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 much better than he was, though it's not all sort of, and he lived happily ever after, and we'll get to that. But what's the lesson for the broader community that is dealing with this challenge?
Well, I think it's that it's looking at a blind spot that a lot of us so-called neurotypical people do. That is just the term of art for normal. I'm not sure what that term means, frankly, anymore.
Sure.
I think we're all on various spectrums. I think we're recognizing that now. But what we did was say, be more like us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, jump around between subjects. You know, listen to what the teacher's saying.
Learn
and send it back.
Like us. Talk like
exactly.
us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to be the way. But because we felt that way, these affinities were seen as perseverative and obsessive. Cut them off. Wean the kids off them. Now the view, since the book came out, is that they're more pathway than prison. And if you go deep into them, live inside of them with the kid, you'll find that down there in that underground cavern, each of these kids seems to have one of these. There's navigation equipment. There's language that means this and that. There are ways that the kids are processing it to understand themselves. And eventually, as what happened with Owen, and we have it happening with other families that call us, we created a vehicle that he now drives out into the world. That is something that he's in charge of. Because this affinity is deeply rooted in him. And, you know, look, the fact is, it's the idea is that the DNA of all things is found in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the lesson. Let them be more like themselves rather than more like us.
Let me introduce Walt Suskind. And Ron, of course, this is your older son. He graduated from college in 2011. He's now a public affairs specialist at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. He joins us from NPR in Washington. And Walt, good to have you and good to meet you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for doing this. I wondered if I could talk to you about this really interesting double life that was created in your household. I mean, your dad's going off and working at the Wall Street Journal as a reporter. You're going off, if I have this right, to a prep school during the day. Then you come home to your family and to Owen at the end of the day, and you're all engaged in this kind of Disney therapy to reach him. What was that like for you?
It was something that, for the most part, definitely stayed in the house. Being a fifth grader,
I'm only laughing because your dad's sitting across the table and laughing.
Don't
too,
bring this
so
out. Well, Walt, you
so
remember
it's infectious.
There
yeah,
was sometimes
exactly.
it would bleed out of the house, though. You remember that, right?
It definitely would. But I'll say, as a fifth grader, you're not getting a lot of social currency telling people you're watching the Jungle Book down in the basement with your little brother and parents. But
right.
It was. You know, that was our camp. That was our campfire that we gathered around.
Ron, you describe Walt at one point in the book as a junior adult at age 7.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, Walt is. It was always kind of a tough, independent kid from the very start. Talked to adults. He would make his way in any situation. And by the time Walt gets to be about 7 or 8, we're sitting him down and saying, "Well, obviously your brother's a little different." And of course, Walt realizes this almost before we do, at the very instant when it's happening. And at the same time, we probably didn't recognize the struggles that Walt had trying to navigate this double life. There was a story in the book where Walt, going to the first day of first grade at a new school, 5 blocks from the school, he tells Cornelia, "Let me out here, I'm fine."
Oh, boy.
And Cornelia's like, "Walt, this isn't Dickens. They know you have parents." And he's like, "No, I'm good." Out he goes. Well, we use that as part of Walt Junior Adult, you know?
Yeah.
And he rode his bike to school on his own, too. Well, Walt later explains to us, when I had to report this book with my son, which was sometimes a little uncomfortable, he says, "Look, it was just me, Owen, and Mom in the car. And if Mom brought Owen in, bringing me in, everyone would see what Owen was up to. And sixth grade boys can be a cruel bunch." That was the reality. That Walt worked his way through quite powerfully and admirably, which is a big part of what's often so evocative that readers are seeing in the book.
Walt, how do you sort of articulate or recall, for instance, that episode of getting close to school and saying, "Mom, this is good enough. I'll take it from here"?
Absolutely. It was pretty much like my dad described it. It was tough. I mean, when Owen was in public with us, kids would laugh, kids would point, and being, you know, 7 or 8 years old, you know, I couldn't go long form and tell them about that Owen was autistic and this and that and neurological differences and, you just kind of don't know what to do, and you want to protect your older brother at all costs. And yeah, basically my calculation was if kids wouldn't see him, then they couldn't make fun of him.
Ron, I need to ask you, and this is a sort of crucial part of the story, how is Owen doing now?
Well, Owen is at a school out in Cape Cod. It's a school for folks, some are the autism spectrum, other kids with different kinds of challenges. He'll be graduating in 2 weeks after 3 years there. And it's been a great time there for him. As soon as he got there, he started Disney Club, of course, to meet people like him, he says, and to find answers, kind of whatever that means. And first year, there's 12 kids. Now there's 35 kids in it, and they all speak Disney. As well as they do that and meditate on it like philosophers, little social connections are forming in Disney Club, several boyfriend-girlfriend mixes, including Owen.
You know, Ron, as our time winds down, I sort of want to get a couple of sort of final ideas from you. And early in the book, you write about watching Owen in a class at a special needs school in Maryland. This is not long after his diagnosis. And this is a pretty dark scene. You're reflecting on the dreams many parents have for their young children, that their kids could be presidents, Nobel Prize winners, or just graduates of fine colleges. But as you watch Owen spinning around, murmuring to himself at that point in his life, you realize those dreams are going to, you know, you're smashing them in the corner in your mind. So this book represents such a sort of evolution for you, because what do you think now about these dreams for your son?
Our education begins at that moment. We're sitting there, and a Down syndrome kid in the class comes up and hugs Cornelia and I and says, "I love you." You know, of course, we were just beginning our process of learning how subtle ability is, often emotional acuity, sensitivities. Kids like Owen, even Down syndrome kids, have very, very high quotients of these abilities. Even if they're difficult to measure, doesn't mean they're not there.
Right.
And that's what we learn, the subtleties between ability and disability, and ultimately how we all find a way to express our essence. Owen is doing that now more and more. And so his dreams are now ones that are really his own.
Yeah.
He's carrying them forward in his very improvisational path. He wants to be an animator at Disney. That's just his dream, his life dream. And actually, he's closer to that kind of thing now than he ever could have imagined, I think. Ultimately, our hope is that he has an independent and self-directed life. He will always be autistic. The challenges come every 5 seconds as he makes his way in the world. But he is living the life that he's more and more choosing for himself.
That's Ron Susskind, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. From our interview back in 2014, we also heard from his son, Walter Susskind. And the new documentary, Life Animated, is having its Boston area premiere tonight at the Kendall Square Theater. And it's going to be followed by a discussion with Ron and his family. You can get a lot more information at RadioBoston.org. And that's it for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend, peaceful weekend, and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.